Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Registrars across the state are busy tallying returns for the midterm. With the number of mail-in and drop-off ballots, it's a process that requires patience and steadiness. We're going to check in with California's Chief Elections Officer, Secretary of State Shirley Weber. Secretary Weber, who is also up for election, will be embarking on her first full term since being appointed by Governor Newsom. The AP has called the race in Weber's favor. Joining us now is Secretary Weber with a look at how election results are shaping up and what voters should keep in mind with a few weeks until results are certified. Good morning, Secretary Weber.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you. Thank you for making the time. Busy week for you, I would imagine. You know, I want to peel back the curtain a little bit because although a lot of people know what the Secretary of State's office does, you know, perhaps the inner workings and the responsibilities may be lesser known. What's currently going on within your office and, you know, the 36 hours since polls closed?
Right. We work with all the counties in the state. So the 58 counties that that really administer the elections, and our staff works with all of them, and they all of our registrar voters, whether they're elected or whether they're appointed by their county board of supervisors. We work with them to make sure they have the necessary information, the necessary support to accomplish the goals of the election. So the elections really are done at the local level. So we continue to work with them throughout, actually months before the election begins. They have weekly meetings to make sure everybody's got all the materials and things that are ready. We test all the machines for them. Those kinds of things take place at the state level and the local level. And then, of course, during election day, all of our staff is on hand. Their staff is on hand. We're basically troubleshooting at the state level any issue that might arise. And this was a very smooth election without glitches and those kinds of things that occur. But we have a staff that supports them. So we're their support staff. All the data comes into our office. I was there the night when the polls closed at 8 o'clock. And it's in our office that we push the button that basically starts the counties from sending in their data and reporting that information to us. So we become like the central hub for all of the counties to send their information to. So they're working at the local counties, depending on their size. They're working to get all the ballots counted and then turning them into us periodically so that we get the information. And so we end up with all the information at at the state level for state offices, as well as those that are local. But the local, actually, if you want to know who won at the local level, immediately you'd go to your registrar of voters for your county.
Yeah, and there's a lot of close races at the local level, that's for sure,
yes,
across the state. So overall, you say the voting went smooth. Were there any isolated issues of concern or learning lessons to apply for future elections?
You know, we always learn something new. We had one, not so much us, but an issue at a county level with regards to technology. It had nothing to do with elections, though. And so we immediately got involved and rerouted all the information to us in a different way. But we learned then that, say, hey, we need to work probably not just with our registrar voters, but oftentimes with our county election individuals who run their technology to make sure they're on board and know sometimes our chain of command if anything happens to affect the elections. In this case, it didn't affect it, but we learned that we need to stay in touch with them as well.
Yeah. You know, and I understand when there are issues, it's a case by case basis. But what kind of protocols are in place if an issue does arise at a polling place on election day?
Oh, wow. If something happens at a polling place, depending on what it is, if it's technology, that's one thing. But if it turns out to be an incident of a person basically causing difficulty at that particular site, our folks have been trained to how to de-escalate situations to make sure people are okay and to keep everyone safe. If that fails, if they're not able to do that, then they are to contact us, to contact their local sheriffs. If they contact us, then we'll make sure we have a group with not only our AG office, but with our highway patrol, as well as our FBI. So we have a system that goes from one level to the next to make sure that people are safe and that person is removed from that environment.
Yeah, we've been having conversations leading up to the midterm and since really the primary with county registrars about just really kind of being in this unprecedented time of tension. And we have talked multiple times with the California Voter Foundation and the nonprofit. They published a report that said since November of 2020, so, you know, 2 years ago, 20 of the state's 58 county registrars, that's about over a third, have either left their positions or just chosen not to seek re-election, in part due to increased and aggressive abusive behavior that's targeted at them. Can you talk to us about what your office's role is in this, and what you're doing to recruit and to also retain local registrars and election workers across the state?
Well, the counties basically recruit their registrar voters. In other words, the county does the hiring and the selection, so we have very little to do with that. And if they choose to run for office, then the county actually administers the election. What we have done, however, is that we've made sure that everyone understands the Bill of Rights, the voting Bill of Rights, to make sure that folks are safe. We've made clear to our registrar voters that we will protect them as much as we possibly can, and whoever decides to disrupt situations, we'll prosecute them to the maximum extent of the law. The AG's office has worked with us on that, as well as the FBI. We've created a law that safe at home for those who feel that their personal information is out that others can see, that they can now be protected from having their information shared with others, so that people will not know their phone numbers and their addresses and those kinds of things. So we've done those things to make sure that people are protected. Sometimes folks quit because, one, they've served for many, many years. We have a lot of registrar voters who love their job and have served for many, many years, and now it's become much more complicated. So they're thinking, so we've had folks to retire. But we also have to deal with poll workers, people who don't want to be harassed. You know, it was such a nice, wonderful job that they did that was really filled with love and commitment to our counties. And now it becomes a tense situation, much more than they wanted. And so we have folks who decided after years just not to work the polls. We then, at a statewide level, however, we do recruit poll workers. We do recruit individuals to work. So if a county discovers that they have fewer than is required, we will help them find individuals, and we have helped them find individuals to work at their local polls that may come from other counties. We do that. And we've been recruiting high school students who love to work at the polls, and they make money. They get paid for being there. And so we've done that through our program of working with high school students and getting them registered. So thus far, we haven't been in a situation where we haven't had our polls adequately manned in terms of staff that's there. But it is something we're concerned about. And as a result, we're doing those kinds of things that make them safer, to make sure that they know that we're protecting them. We've gone out and we look at their physical facilities, particularly in the smaller areas, to make sure that that what they need for security is there, and that we work to make sure that they're safe. So we haven't had any incidents of real difficulty here, and we're fortunate in that sense. But we are aware that those kinds of things and threats and, you know, people getting angry about situations do occur. But we didn't have much happening like that this time, and we're very grateful for that.
I was a high school poll worker, so I know that program quite well.
That's great.
You know, and I guess
great.
The overarching issue is that, you know, faith in the electoral process has come under intense scrutiny, perhaps with a small but also passionate group of voters. I'm curious, your office, you oversee 500 employees. How is the atmosphere within the Secretary of State's office?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, people don't know that the voting section is really not the largest section of the Secretary of State's office. Our largest section is our business filings and nonprofit filings. That is the largest unit that we have in our office. So many of our employees don't directly work with elections. They volunteer during election time, and they'll man the hotline and things like that. So we have a great sense of volunteer among our staff, but most of them don't do that. We have we have a great team of individuals who've been kind of the deputies and the assistant managers in terms of elections, and have many, many years of working with elections. So they meet regularly. I meet with them. We meet with our county regularly. And so we have a wonderful team of individuals who know elections backwards and forwards, and who are on who have a system that to me was just absolutely amazing to watch, because it's so intricate and it has so many small pieces to it to ensure that elections go smoothly. So I have a team of an election section in the department that really handles all of the elections, deal with all the issues, and we're very fortunate to have them. Many of them have 20, 30 years of experience of running elections. And so they're not the faces you often see, but when I go down to meet with them, they're there, and they know how important the role is that they play. So we have a great team, but it's not the largest team, interestingly enough.
Oh.
And so there's always really excitement on election night, you know, if you come down, if you were in the building, you would see not only all the workers, but you see all the food and all the potlucks and the things that they do, because they're there from early morning to the next day, making sure these things happen. And they're there right now.
Despite it being easier than ever to register, we have like record registration in recent years. There's like some 22 million ballots that were mailed out. There is a gap, obviously, between voter registration and turnout. I was talking to one analyst who said yesterday that they would project like a 50% turnout with this midterm. Currently, it's about a third at like 32%. Why do you think that is? I mean, when we get ballots a month in advance and have ample time to mail them in or drop them off?
You know, we're going to look at that, and we're going to find to see whether or not our new system is as effective as our old system in terms of everybody getting a ballot. It's hard to predict why people don't vote. For those of us who vote all the time and take it so seriously, it's mind-boggling that people would get a ballot and not turn it in, or wait to the very last minute and then try to figure out because we send out a lot of notices. And you probably know, if you're a voter, you get booklets, you get cards from us, the reminding of where to go and that it was getting close to the time and all those kinds of things. And we notify you when your ballot has been received and been counted. If you sign up for Where's My Ballot, we've done all these things to make it easier for people. And I think it's just a matter of individual motivation. You know, most folks figure the world will be okay, even if they don't vote. And only when it seems like there's something that's earth-shattering or that they're angry about or, you know, it's urgent at the moment, will they rush to the polls and vote as they did in 2020. So we're looking at that. We'll be meeting to talk about once we realize what the turnout is. We don't know yet, because with this new system comes new challenges. It's going to take us longer to figure out who's winning. It's taking us longer because the ballots come in waves, you know, some in the mail, some here, some dropped off into boxes. And so we've got all those different things of ways in which people can vote. And so it makes it more complicated than simply having a one day and one kind of activity that occurs. But we are looking at that. It's still mind boggling as to why folks don't just vote. And I'm not sure whether they feel disconnected. We've had so many events with young people as well as with adults about voting. And one thing we know, that those who are older vote, you know, those over the age of 65 actually vote. So maybe we need to have some conversations with them to help our young folks and others in between to figure out why they don't vote and why these folks are so committed to voting.
Do you think a piece of that is California inclusive of political views in a state where Democrats have a supermajority and we have a top two system where sometimes opposing candidates can be of the same party, which often is the case, is Dem on Dem?
Yeah, yeah. We'll look at that. I don't know. I mean, having low voter turnout is not something new. It's not affiliated with the top two vote getter. I can remember years ago when there would be really poor turnout, 30-40% of the electorate would be turning out to vote. Sometimes people feel it's a done deal that the president's going to win anyway, because he was already in office and they don't really have a gripe. So they figure, you know, others will handle it for them. It's something we have to look at very carefully. There are Dem on Dem races, but they're not always Dem on Dem races. You know, most of the time they're not. And there are few, and I think I was looking at them, maybe a few in the state that are Dem on Dem races in terms of partisanism. But it's just, it is mind-boggling, and we continue to work on it. But I think sometimes when people don't feel a sense of urgency, they don't move forward with it. Where if they're voting against something or for something, they will. And if they're kind of confused, sometimes they don't vote. If we have too many initiatives on the ballot and there's too many commercials and there's too many whatever, people say, I'm just going to vote against everything. So they just stay home, you know?
Yeah. Are there parts of the role of Secretary of State to your office that you wish Californians knew more about? I know earlier this year when you joined us, we did talk about the role in helping small businesses and nonprofits.
Yes, we are in the process right now with our outreach program. We kind of took a slight deep breath as we finished the elections, but we have a list of activities. We're trying to make sure that everyone in California understands all of the work that occurs as Secretary of State. You know, we have an amazing archive, and they're forever putting on programs and things and history facts and information that people are excited about once they go into the archives. Surely our businesses and our nonprofits, we're getting ready to basically highlight them and create some opportunities in terms of some town hall meetings for small businesses and nonprofits to get the information they need to stay effective and alive. So we are in the process of doing that. We're doing things with our Public Record Acts folks to help understand what we do in terms of when people want information and request information, what the rules and regulations are with regards to folks who run for office. You know, there's a whole unit that does that. So we are, Janelle Jackson is our outreach coordinator, and we're in the process of putting the calendar together for the year that will show all the things that we're planning. They've been planning it and working with different organizations, and we're bringing in some people whose specialty is working with businesses and nonprofits in our outreach office, so that they will be working with a lot of our businesses, and we're working with a lot of our chamber as well to help them to understand how they interface with us, but also how they can help even with elections.
Finally, what are your priorities for your upcoming full term?
Wow. Well, first of all, there are a couple of things that are lingering that have to be done. We have to basically do our CARS project, that California Access. We're in the process, we're in the second phase of that. And so I'm totally committed to making sure that that thing comes off and it comes off correctly. So we are working with CARS, our CARS project. We are very much, as I said, involved with young people. And so working with our Secretary of State on civic education and helping them to understand what we mean when we say democracy and those kinds of things, because some people understand it, young people do, some don't. So we're working with our young people to really create a greater and stronger unit that's there, trying to get not only everyone to vote, to register, but to get them to vote. And that's going to be a major issue for all of us, because we are at 83% of Californians actually registered to vote right now, 22 million. We need to see that 22 million at the polls. We still have about 5 or 6 million that are not registered, because there's 27 million that are eligible to vote. And so we need to really figure out why people don't and vote, and figure out how we can basically be more effective in not only recruiting them to vote, register, which is important, but more importantly, getting them to the polls on the day of the election. So we're going to be analyzing the data to figure out what we can do with our community groups to basically get greater numbers of people on a regular basis voting. Maybe after this election, people will be more comfortable with a vote by mail ballot. I know when Colorado implemented, it was difficult now, but, you know, Colorado gets about 80% to 90% of their registered voters actually voting in every election now. So we're looking to see where that is in other places and try to duplicate that here. And of course, you know, continuing to grow our businesses and make sure we are an asset and a resource to those businesses, and not just somebody who comes in when they didn't file or some difficulty happened and they, you know, then have a complaint. Yeah.
Secretary Weber, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. You guys have a great day.
You too. That is California Secretary of State Shirley Weber. Up next, we head up to Shasta County and check in with the head of elections to see how this week has been after a contentious primary drew national attention. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Concern of political violence has begun to fade as Election Day across the country largely proceeded as planned, with many state and local election officials reporting the democratic process went without incident. But tensions rose in the weeks leading up to the midterm after reports of armed people watching ballot boxes in Arizona, the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, as well as candidates from both parties who were assaulted, and warnings of a heightened threat to the election due to a rise in domestic violent extremism. A potential flashpoint for these political tensions in this year's midterm was Shasta County, where a primary election led to some tense moments at the county elections office back in June. Shortly after the primary, Kathy Darling Allen, the county registrar of voters, joined us to discuss navigating an unprecedented election. Registrar Allen joins us now to share how the week has been and how she's become a national advocate for election workers. Registrar Allen, welcome back to Insight. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much, Ricky. Great to see you as well.
Yeah, you know, there is a lot of work that your staff does, both in the lead up to and in the days and weeks after the big election day. But before we dive into all of that, just how are you and your staff doing?
We're doing pretty well. We had a pretty good day on Tuesday. Lots and lots of voters. We had lots of voters here in our office, especially. And because it was raining here in Shasta County, that meant that we were kind of walking all over each other to accommodate all the traffic that we had. But that's what we're here for. And so we welcomed the traffic. And it was a pretty good day overall on Tuesday.
So the winter storm didn't deter any voters. It still led to a good turnout?
I think so. We have literally thousands of ballots left to process, and we're going to try and get a handle on that later this morning so we can report to my friend, Dr. Weber, what we have left to process later today.
When we last spoke with you after a contentious primary election in which some supporters of far-right candidates, they confronted you at the election offices, and it led to a long, heated discussion about the integrity of the vote. How did Tuesday night compare with the primary in June?
We implemented a whole host of new security protocols in between those two elections. And so things were pretty calm. We did have a couple of people who objected to those protocols, but we were able to utilize our partners in law enforcement. We had sheriff deputies here inside the office to help with folks who had questions in person. And then we also had our local police who responded outside. We had one person, obtained a special event permit to close the alley behind our office so that when poll workers were driving through the alley to drop off their ballots and so forth, folks could observe, but from a certain distance away. And there was some objection to not being able to be 3 feet away. They wanted to be 3 feet away instead of 25 feet away. And that conversation was heated, but ended peacefully with some police intervention. And then those folks did stay behind the barricades for the rest of the evening. So we were happy with that outcome.
Yeah. When you mentioned that alleyway, I remember you telling me back in June following the primary, I mean, weren't even like cameras planted, you know, in a bush, you know, back in the alleyway surveilling?
Correct. Yeah. We had a game camera that had been put up the night before. We found out later. And then it was taken down at some point later in the evening, or early morning, I should say, of Wednesday that week. In any case, none of that occurred this time. And I think, you know, our dedication and hours spent planning paid off.
Yeah. And when the polls did close on Tuesday, I was reading that there was a small group that did show up to your office with signs expressing support for you and your staff. I mean, what did that expression of support mean to you and your staff?
It really is tremendously important and validating. And I want to add, they're not the only folks that we've heard from. We've gotten thank you cards in the mail literally almost daily for the last about 6 weeks. And so we really appreciate the support of the community. I think the election results in June really cemented for me an understanding of what the voters want in our county, and that extreme reaction is not what the voters supported, that those candidates did not win in June's election. Obviously, we don't know the results for the November election. We still have lots of ballots left to count, but we'll see if it remains true in November as well.
And you've been very vocal as well. I mean, you spoke with, you know, national publications like the New York Times and when talking about the concerns about the threat of violence. And I believe in that article, you said you never dreamt that one day you'd be coming up with a plan to what to do if you were physically attacked or at worst, you got shot. Did that realization, the fact that you have to reconcile this and kind of and think about something that you were really never prepared to as a registrar, did it ever lead you to reconsider running for re-election or maybe potentially stepping down?
Yeah,
because you've been doing this for a while. So
yeah, no, I have. I actually had I rolled past my 18th anniversary in September, of working in the elections department here in Shasta County. So it has been a minute. And I think that you talked earlier with Secretary Dr. Weber about the people leaving the field. Mm-hmm. Certainly I've had those thoughts and kind of had to go through my own grieving process, frankly, about the way that this job has changed. It is not the same job that it was when I started 18 years ago. But what the mission of defending the voters and defending our republic has never changed. But what we have to do now to accomplish that mission is different. So I think what we're seeing are, and I absolutely don't fault anyone who doesn't want to make that pivot, right? To really accept the fact that the job they've done for a while is not the same job that they accepted, right? I did not sign up for folks threatening me or following me to my car or any of that kind of stuff, right? And neither did any other election official that I'm aware of in the United States. But every election official I've ever met who does this work has a foundational and fundamental understanding of how important the work we do is every day. It's not just election day that's important, right? But obviously, it's the day we get the most attention. So certainly, I've had those thoughts and those concerns, and I know others have as well. And I hope that me being willing to speak out encourages folks, especially those who are younger than me in the profession, to stay in the profession. I know that there is a lot of talk about term limits and bureaucrats being in office for too long. But when you have institutional knowledge of a process that's as layered and complex as conducting elections, especially in a state like California, where we have such complicated ballots, so many language requirements, things that are just really exceptional, that institutional knowledge and that the years of experience are important. So I want to encourage folks who are younger and are amazing. In Sacramento right now, you have an amazing registrar of voters in Hang Nguyen. She is brilliant and smart and young, and I hope she and others like her stay in office and stay on the path, as I will for my next term. But it's really just an incredibly important job, and it's incredibly important that we have people who are experienced and non-biased conducting this work.
Yeah. You know, given that nationally, you know, there were reports that there was a poll worker shortage, but that wasn't the case for you. I mean, you had told a local news station that you were fully staffed. What went into the recruitment and the training process that your office undertook?
So in general, in November, we just don't have a hard time recruiting poll workers. That historically, that's a pretty consistent pattern. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that everyone knows that there's an election in November. It's never a surprise to anyone. But June and March election dates are a little tougher, right? March can be a break time for schools. Certainly in June, early June elections are always conflicting with folks' vacations or graduations and other things like that. So those, just by nature of when the elections are, kind of presents a little bit of a challenge, but November is almost never a problem. So we did our normal recruiting, nothing really exceptional for this election.
Mm. You, when we first started talking, you said that since June, you put some different measures in place to kind of prevent what happened in June for the general election, the midterm. And there were a couple things that kind of popped up for us. It was like in September, your office put out a public notice about possible voter intimidation occurring within Shasta County. The same month, you hosted a webinar and you sent out flyers to residents to combat misinformation and disinformation. How successful were those measures and those protocols?
So I hope that the webinar was helpful. What had happened, the webinar and the voter intimidation is kind of connected in one larger incident that's all connected. There was a person who had been brought to our county to do a presentation, whose name is Doug Frank. He's appeared with Mike Lindell in the past, and he has a particular way that he analyzes data that is really incorrect and inaccurate. And so some of our citizens here brought him to the Board of Supervisors in mid-September. And one of the techniques that he espouses is finding phantom voters. And so the way that he encourages local groups to combat it is by obtaining the list of registered voters and then knocking on doors to make sure that the people who live there are the people on the list. This activity, though, and the way that it was performed, caused multiple people to call, contact us and complain that they felt targeted, that they felt intimidated. And so we got contacted by three people on one weekend, and then the next weekend, I got contacted by another voter who literally called the police before these folks left their property, and they were very upset by the contact. And this was not a situation where they were going door to door on a block. They were literally driving into a neighborhood, parking in front of folks' house, knocking on the door, and then getting back in their cars and leaving. So there was no, and that was the same story I heard from all the people who I spoke to. So it was very troubling, and I wanted to make sure, so we did the press release, to make sure that other voters in our community understand that, number one, that effort was not undertaken by my office, and that we would never contact people door-to-door randomly in that way, and also that if someone else, other voters were contacted, that they had no obligation to speak to those folks. They don't have to answer questions, and specifically, they don't have to answer questions about people who do not live there. So imagine if you're living in an apartment, and you just moved in 2 months ago and registered to vote there, and someone knocks on your door and is yelling at you about people's names who you don't know who may have lived in that apartment prior to you. How could the current resident possibly be responsible for that kind of information? So in any case, in an effort to kind of combat the information that that Doug Frank was spreading in our Board of Supervisors meeting and also in a private meeting he had at a local church where I am told about 120 people attended at the cost of $20 a head. We put on a webinar, there's a gentleman who is a professor and a fellow at the Hoover Institution in Stanford, Professor Justin Grimmer. He agreed to come online in a virtual sense and do a webinar with us. And that's on my website, the office's website now, if folks want to take a look at that, kind of breaking down and explaining and debunking the analysis protocols that Doug Frank uses. Just as an example, one of the things that he said at our Board of Supervisors meeting in mid-September was that the rate of voters, the number of voters, were growing faster than our population. So he was comparing the voter file and its growth over time to the census data. Well, in 2018 in California, we started automatically registering folks as they went through the DMV process. He's from Ohio, so he probably doesn't know that, but that's a very logical and clear reason why our number of voters would have gone up in the last 5 years faster than the population. So that's just an example of the misinformation and the spin that's put mm-hmm. on information around elections right now. That's just patently false and misleading. But, you know, when it's packaged and presented in such a slick and professional way, like Mike Lindell is able to do, you know, I don't have $40 million to put a light screen behind me and have a makeup person and a wardrobe person and a producer and a director and a scriptwriter and all the things that that kind of money would purchase for me and allow me to present this amazing, very engaging and deceiving presentation. So
that was a mouthful. That was a lot. And I'm just curious, since this is your 18th year serving Shasta County in elections, is there a time that compares to this for you in nearly two decades?
No, absolutely not. This is, like I said, I absolutely kind of went through my own grieving process about this job and about the way things have changed. But I feel at a very base level that our country needs us. Our country needs those of us who are willing to step forward and willing to hold the line. We have to continue to do that. I know that the national election results, a lot of election deniers did not win their races this week, which is a great thing for our country, but that does not mean that the battle is won.
When looking at the general and the primary, were there some learning lessons or incidents that came up with your office? There were a couple of, I think, mishaps that your office took responsibility for the city council race, and also that about 300 voters in Reading received the wrong ballot type for the midterm. Can you just explain like what exactly happened, what you learned from it, and what you're going to take from it moving forward?
Sure. You know, part of what has happened for our office, and I'm sure for offices around the country, is having to lay redistricting processes on top of regular election processes because of the delay in census results due to COVID last year. So normally we would have gotten census data in April. We did not get it until August last year, which really delayed things. Additionally, here locally, we did not get information. One of our local community college districts moved their boundaries totally within reason, and we expect that to happen during the redistricting process, but we had no notice or consultation in that process. And so as a result, the lines that they drew not only drew them right through the middle of precincts, which causes us an enormous amount of additional work, but they in some cases even bisected parcels, so divided properties in half. So that's when you, it's kind of like taking a jigsaw puzzle, and instead of putting it together in a different way, you start cutting the pieces apart. So it just creates a whole exponential level of work that our staff had to undertake in the middle of trying to canvass the June election and then prepare for candidate filing to begin on July 14th. In addition to that, on July 12th, I believe, we were at our Board of Supervisors, that's the correct date, talking about a recount of June's election. So, you know, all of these efforts to distract, unfortunately, were in to some degree successful. So we, as you say, we had one particular group of voters, the 291 voters to be exact, who we had gotten to the wrong district. And so that was a very easy fix. And we mailed all those voters new ballots at the beginning of the absentee period in early October. The city council race was strictly human error on our part, combined with some problems in candidate filing on the city's part. And because the city, when they filed their candidates, did not ask any of their candidates if they wanted to vote for a two-year or a four-year seat, which all should have been on ballot, they only had one of those or two of those seats on ballot for the 4 years. So what was missing was a two-year seat. But because none of the candidates had answered that question, we couldn't kind of go back in time and recreate those ballots. So we have a special election happening in the city of Shasta Lake in our county on March 7th next year.
Finally, you know, since all of this, I mean, you have become a national advocate for election workers and, you know, a very strong critic of election deniers. I mean, you testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee on a hearing about protecting frontline workers. You're also a member of the Future of California Elections Network, which works to advance policies and practices to ensure equitable access to the democratic process for all voters. Finally, what gives you optimism that this will endure?
I love this country. I believe in this country and what it was founded on. Bring us, you're tired, you're hungry. I absolutely believe that that is what makes America stronger and better. And I do believe it may get worse before it gets better, but that it will get better. We have the community I live in has pluses and minuses, but there are overall, I love this community. All my children live here. My granddaughter lives here. We have amazingly generous people in our community. And I know that's true for the nation as well. I've spent a lot of time in other states besides California. I actually grew up back east. So I have a little bit wider view, maybe. And my little tiny view is that our country is strong. And it is fragile. The democracy that we all love and cherish is fragile. So we really have to continue to fight to preserve it.
Registrar Allen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Kathy Darling Allen is the Registrar of Voters in Shasta County. Still ahead, we'll meet the Beatles Guitar Project, a nonprofit advancing music education across Northern California, ahead of their epic 40-piece orchestra performance this weekend. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schloem. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, welcome to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the Magical Mystery Tour, which is taking place this weekend with the Beatles Guitar Project. The concert is a collaboration of students and professional musicians performing iconic Beatles music. The concert benefits schools with a need to fund their music programs. So joining us to talk about the Beatles Guitar Project is founder Ben McClara and Cap Radio classical musical host Jennifer Reason. Good morning.
Good morning.
What a fun way to end the show. So, Ben, I want to start with you. You're a Sacramento State, Sac State alumni. You've performed as a principal bassist for universities at the orchestra. But what else have you performed?
Well, you've done your homework, haven't you?
And you looked at me like I was like I was crazy. Right,
how did you know that?
Some CIA stuff.
Yeah, some spy stuff going on.
I've been playing in Sacramento since 96, playing in rock bands and jam bands and hip hop bands and ska bands, like Filibuster is a pretty famous Sacramento group. And I was doing all of that stuff in like the late 90s and the early 2000s. And at the same time, I was going to Sac State and I was honing my chops on stand-up bass. So I'm a classical bass major. And playing in the orchestra and playing jazz. And I went to American River College and I played jazz with Joe Gilman there. And so I feel like I came up in the ranks in Sacramento and studied with some pretty fantastic people.
How did that lead to the Beatles Guitar Project?
Well, I started the Sacramento Preparatory Music Academy in 2011, but we weren't a nonprofit yet. And then we became a nonprofit in 2015, and we moved to the Clara in Midtown, the Performing Arts Studios on N. And we needed to renovate our studios upstairs, and so we put on this big show, and my guitar students were like, you know, what are we going to do for the show? And I had a student that said, you know, we almost know all of Sgt. Pepper's. And I'm like, that's a good idea. Like, let's do the whole record. It's only 45 minutes long. It's like a big suite. We'll just look at it as a big suite. And of course, we could not do like Within You, Without You with the Indian classical tablas and all that stuff. So we played it as a blues.
Cool.
And Peter Petty came out and he and I sang the whole show. And then we had a bunch of other music that happened and we raised like 25 grand. And we renovated our classroom into four teachable studios. And so then we host a bunch of teachers through the years over there, and they have a great place to teach.
That's wonderful. Now we're here several years later with the fall 2022 tour, and you have two concerts taking place this weekend, one in Santa Rosa, I believe,
yes.
And then also one here in Sacramento.
Yeah, we'll be at the Luther Burbank Center in Santa Rosa. And I've been talking to a lot of people about that show, too. So we're very, very excited.
What's the audience like taking in a 40-piece orchestra and obviously just like iconic Beatles music?
It's pretty incredible. You know, the first time we did Abbey Road was across the street from here at the Scottish Rite. And we had a lot of people from the city of Sacramento that we gave tickets to. And they showed up and they said, you know, I thought I was coming to a child's music recital. And here are all these professional musicians playing. And this is incredible. And it's really incredible for the kids. And I got to be honest, it's been more than incredible for the kids ever since.
Yeah, I would imagine playing with professional musicians.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you really don't see. You know, you go to a school and you get into a band and you play along the side of, you know, other students. And you go to college and you learn repertoire and then you go on stage and you play by yourself or you play with college students. But there's not really a lot of, at least I haven't seen it, you know, a lot of situations where the majority of the band is a professional band and the students are like scholarship students. And so that's a real new concept. And, you know, I've been rolling with that since 2016.
I mean, talk about like geeking out, like as a burgeoning like musician and being with professional music. It really helps you visualize what your life and your passion and your career could be in music.
Yeah, it gives kids, students of music, I'll call them students of music. It gives them a real sense of like, what a professional environment is like. So they watch Jennifer play piano. They listen to the horn players. They watch Darren Baker play drum set. And they're like, so excited. One of the most exciting things that we do is the first read through at the auditorium with the entire orchestra. And it's real relaxed. And all the singers come in, like Peter Petty, and Hans Eberbach and Kitty O'Neill comes in to sing, and Jessica Malone comes, and Gabe Nelson. They all know Gabe Nelson. They're like, he used to play for Cake. Like, he's one of my heroes. I love all those records. I'm so excited to play with these people. And then, you know, it's just like it all happens. And, you know, it's a real the experience is quite exhilarating.
All right, Jennifer, how did you get brought into all of this? I mean, I follow you on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. I also see you at work. You're
yes.
the classical musical host, but you're just bouncing around.
Yeah.
Yeah. All like from one lily pad to another, you know, you're just performing all the time.
Absolutely. And I will say I knew of this band well before I got to play. I joined back, I think, in 2018, but I was watching it and being like, this is awesome. I want to do that. And then Ben finally called, like, yes. So yeah, I've been playing since 2018.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think your first show was on the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' White Album.
That surely was.
So we've had some tremendous anniversary shows. We've had the 51st anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's, the 50th anniversary of the White Album, like I just said. We also did the 50th anniversary of Abbey Road. So we have a lot of albums under our belts. And I would say that is the bulk of the work that goes into all these things. This show does not exist. Like, you just can't call Pepper, J.W. Pepper, and be like, yeah, I want to order the White Album book for my orchestra so that we can do the White Album. Like, nobody has that stuff. And so it's been a mission, ongoing struggle to transcribe the music and write it out so we have parts for the whole orchestra. You know, it's a very special thing that we have going here.
It certainly is. We're going to listen to a piece of it. It's I Am the Walrus. We're going to listen to a quick soundbite. I love it. I love all the texture of it. I've never seen it in person, but it really like transports you there. How is it, Jennifer, performing and taking it all in?
Yeah, it couldn't be more fun. I grew up with these albums, obviously. So to hear them in the context of orchestra meets rock band, I cannot describe to you how much sound is on that stage. It's pretty epic.
Matt, what are the challenges, maybe logistically, that exist putting something like this on?
Well, logistically, musically, I would say the big logistical problem is, you know, of course, making all the bookings and the, you know, that the normal stuff. Like before I walked in here, I was calling Enterprise Truck Rental.
Yeah.
I'm on the phone with Enterprise.
The non-sexy stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Musically, the logistics of the music is really, really important. And I learned that in 2017 when we did the White Album for the very first time at the Crest Theater. a violin player who's on this show. Ray Lynn is playing second violin. I said, Ray Lynn, did you love the show? And she goes, yeah, it was okay. And I'm all, oh, what could have been better? And she goes, well, I wish you would write more music for the orchestra. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I have a lot of work to do. I have professional musicians who are bored. Because, I mean, like, if you go listen to the
That's
Beatles.
Quite the epiphany.
Yeah, I know, right? They want to play more. And if you go listen to the Beatles albums, you go, okay, you count all the songs and you go, yeah, well, I have orchestra on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 songs, and there's like 17 songs on Sgt. Pepper's. And then you start to think and you go, okay, what can I do? So the arranging of the records has been. It's a quest. It's a dedication. For instance, like if any of your listeners go on and go listen to the end of I Am the Walrus, I wrote the entire ending of that song for Jennifer.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You're gonna have a blast this weekend.
Definitely.
I'm so excited for you. Ben McClare is the founder of the Beatles Guitar Project, and Jennifer Reason is obviously Cap Radio's classical musical host. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Great
seeing
day.
You.
Thanks for
and
having us.
And the Beatles Guitar Project will perform Sunday, November 13th at Sacramento's Memorial Auditorium. So this weekend. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a fantastic weekend.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.